welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, October 17th. 17th, 2012. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and Writers on Writing, as always, is dedicated to writers, books, and publishing. Today, my guests are Constance Hale, author of Vex, Hex, Smash, Smoosh, and Tatiana Soli, who will be here with The Forgetting Tree. First up is Constance Hale. She's the author of Wired Style and Sin and Syntax. She's taught at the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University and UC Berkeley Extension. She's based in San Francisco, and we're here today primarily to talk about Vex, Hex, Smash, Smoosh, Let Verbs Power Your Writing, published by Norton. Hi, Connie.
Hey, Barbara. It's so nice to be with you.
Great to have you back. You were on a few years ago with Sin and Syntax, and I'll tell you, I have put that on every sort of reading list for my students forever because I love that book. I think it's one of the best books, if not the best book on grammar. I just love it. I love everything about it, and I'm so glad you're here to talk about this new one. Tell me how this one came about.
You know, I wrote Sin and Syntax 12 years ago, and I have been teaching throughout the time since I wrote it. And it seemed like the more I taught, sometimes I teach grammar in the context of writing, grammar for writers, but sometimes I just teach writing, narrative journalism, various, you know, basic reporting. And I found that the more and more I worked with Sin and Syntax and more I kept to teach writing, the more and more I kept coming back to verbs as the one thing writers can do to most quickly change their writing. And then I also kept coming back to verbs because so many people had some questions about them. People, when people are trying to do a pretty intricate story, whether fiction or nonfiction, they have questions about tense. You know, a lot of us feel confused about tense. Should I use the present? Should I use the past? What's the difference? And then there was the age-old question of the active voice versus the passive voice, about which there are a lot of misunderstandings and misconceptions that I found myself wanting to straighten people out on. And so it just seemed that there was a lot more to say about verbs, and I love verbs. And by telling the story of the English verb, I could also tell the story of English, and that was an exciting prospect for me. So unlike Sin and Syntax, which really was kind of a subversive, albeit subversive grammar book, this is really a book about language, more deeply about language and the way sentences work and kind of how and why English has evolved into this pretty amazing language that most of us don't take advantage of when we're writing.
Interesting. Talk a little bit about how you grew an interest in language and in writing about language.
You know, I think it comes from really early in my life. I come from an unusual family in that both my parents are beautifully educated, both of my parents are nice writers, and both of my parents are articulate people who insist on proper grammar. And so I grew up in a family where stories, you know, we told stories around the dinner table, and we, as children, were corrected by our parents when we didn't speak correct, when we didn't speak grammatically correct English. But at the same time, I grew up in a little tiny sugar plantation town in Hawaii when most of the people didn't speak the kind of English we spoke around the dinner table. We spoke a pidgin, well, we call it pidgin English in Hawaii. It's the linguists call it Hawaiian Creole. So we spoke a bona fide Creole out on the beach with our friends, and even at school, and even my teacher spoke pidgin English. So I grew up, in a way, speaking two Englishes. I consider myself bilingual in English. And I think from a very early age, I was fascinated by, for example, why my parents didn't let us speak pidgin at the dinner table, and then why they couldn't speak pidgin. It's a language that you almost have to be born with in order to speak correctly. It's so different from standard English. And then I also, at the same time, while I understood formal English and how I was supposed to write a certain way when I was in school. I always felt curious about why jokes told in Pidgin were funnier and why I preferred storytelling in Pidgin English. So I think I grew up with a different idea about language than a lot of people, where I saw non-standard English as something positive, something playful. And it gave me maybe some skepticism towards standard English that a lot of writers or people who grew up on the mainland did not have or do not have.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Constance Hale, and her new book is Vex, Hex, Smash, Smoosh, Let Verbs Power Your Writing, published by Norton. I love the story about you at Princeton and revealing that you spoke Pidgin English, and I think it's in the introduction to this book, and I've heard you tell it before. Would you tell our listeners? Such a great story.
Well, you know, having grown up in Hawaii, as I said, with these two Englishes, of course I went to Princeton University and I was studying English literature. No one spoke Pidgin there. It was like this hidden side of my personality. I wasn't able to speak it with anyone there. And I guess it was a little bit embarrassing the way I grew up. I mean, I was a scholarship student at Princeton. Here I came from the country and in Hawaii, and it made me different. So, but I was an enthusiastic student of English literature and had kind of an amazing professor my junior year whose name was Lawrence Lipking, and he was actually one of the editors of the Norton Anthology. I was taking a class called British and American Poetry, Modern British and American Poetry with him. And we were reading Yeats and T.S. Eliot. And about three-quarters of the way through the class, I was becoming frustrated because I was a young poet at the time. I was trying to figure out how to be a writer myself. And I felt that we always concentrated on very cerebral stuff in poetry. The conversations that we had around Professor Lipking's table were always about the themes and the imagery. So one day I stayed after class and told him my frustration that we weren't talking about the music of poetry. And he was intrigued, and he pulled down a volume of Keats and kind of challenged me to talk about the music of the language. And he and I had a little discussion about that Keats, and I was kind of embarrassed and said, well, he said, you seem to have a very good ear. And I said, well, you know, I grew up speaking Pidgin English. And he looked at me like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, you know, it's this Creole that we speak in Hawaii. We mix Hawaiian words in with Japanese words and Portuguese words, and the syntax is all screwed up, and that's the way we speak. And he said, that's fascinating. Can you give me an example? So I told him the story of Little Lei Puahi and the Wild Pua'a, which is our Little Red Riding Hood and the wild pig, since we don't have a wolf. And it begins, I'll just give you a snippet of it. It begins, one day Little Lei Puahi went come home from school, and her mother went tell, you know, your tutu been stay very sick. Well, better you go take her some cookies or something. So I told him the whole story, and I had this moment, and he loved it. He loved it, and he asked me all these questions about Pidgin. And it was a really transformative moment in my life as a writer, because I realized that these two Englishes, which I had always felt uncertain about the relationship between them, I saw that someone who really loved poetry and was this incredibly erudite professor of the English language and of English writing loved Pidgin. And in a way, it just set me on a course of exploring, really for the rest of my writing career, sort of why and how it is when sentences tick, why they click the way they do, why sometimes when we break the rules, it's actually works better than when we hew faithfully to the rules. And it's just encouraged me, I think, to use my ear more, trust my ear a little bit more, and explore some of the unruly edges of the language.
That's great. And I loved that sample of Pidgin English. It's really beautiful.
It is. It's fun. It's a little body. It's often body and guttural sometimes, but it's a lot of fun to speak it.
I liked what you talked about in Sin and Syntax about breaking the rules, and I like that you just said that again, because I think especially new writers feel that they have to write like writers, which means that they often forget about their voice and try to adhere to the rules, you know, not starting sentences with conjunctions and different things. And sometimes it's kind of difficult to break that out, you know, to kind of get rid of that as a new writer, I think.
Well, and also you have to remember that many, and this is something that I explore in this book as I explore kind of the way English evolved, a lot of the rules that were taught are actually wrong. They come from Latin, they were imposed on English, and they don't actually describe the way English works. So just to give you one example, the myth of a split infinitive, that we're not supposed to split infinitive, people are still taught that in school, and it's crazy. We can split infinitives in English. We've been doing it ever since we've had English. And so, you know, the first problem is a lot of the rules that were taught aren't right in the first place. The second problem is a lot of the rules that were taught, or this sense that we have to write correct sentences, doesn't take us to the most lively and colorful way to say something. So I'm really trying to sort some of that out in this book and give people some reliable tricks or tips or techniques to guide them to more colorful language.
You, further on in the book, almost midway through, I think it is, you talk about storytelling and you know, getting in the storytelling mood. And I think you say something to the effect of that the indicative, here it is, the indicative is your friend. Can you talk about that, that and mood? Because I think a lot of writers who don't really know all the parts of grammar probably don't even know what the indicative is.
Mm-hmm. Well, the indicative just is our, well, let me just pause for one second. There's some confusion sometimes between tense and mood. So tense is just the way we have in English of signaling time. So the present tense, obviously, we're talking about something that's happening right now. The past tense, it happened yesterday or before. And so tense is just about time. It just helps us keep track of time within a story. And it's a very important thing to have control over as a writer, because we want to, when we're telling complicated stories, have the ability to flash back in time, flash forward. The present is often more dramatic. The past can be more lyrical, depending on how you use it. So you want to be able to control tense. But then, completely separate from tense, we have this idea, this thing called mood. And in English, we have three primary moods: the indicative, the imperative, and the subjunctive. And again, the subjunctive is the kind of thing that makes people's, the hair on the back of people's necks raise, you know, makes us nervous and anxious, because most of us can't figure it out, and having spent a chapter trying to figure out, it's pretty hard to explain, even when you understand it. So the idea of mood is, the indicative mood is just the kind of the everyday mood, the average mood, the straightforward mood, the mood that we talk about most of the time in conversation. It's stable, it's easy, it actually comes pretty naturally to us. The imperative mood is the bossy mood, the commanding mood, the you go and do this mood, where you, the writer, are addressing your reader or listener directly and commanding them to do something. But there's kind of another imperative mood also. If you just change your pronouns from you to we, you slide into a more comfortable mood where you're kind of, I call it the collective unconscious mood. In other words, I'm not telling you what to do, Barbara, but I'm talking about something that we both understand, and it's a kind of inclusive and friendly mood. And then the subjunctive is the wishful mood, the mood that we use when we're describing maybe things that aren't actually true, or things that we wish were true but aren't true. And it's a more difficult mood to explain, but there's absolutely, when you're writing, there's no reason to necessarily use a fancy mood. The indicative is fine. And that's what I mean by it's the friendly mood. It's easy. It's what we're most comfortable with. It fits on like a comfortable old jacket. And it's pretty serviceable. Does well by us. But I have to admit that I play a lot with the imperative mood. It's fun, and it allows you to almost establish yourself as a different character, as a narrator.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Constance Hale, and her new book is Vex, Hex, Smash, Smoosh. Talk about the title.
The title is very controversial with my publisher, because it's hard to remember and hard to roll off the tongue sometimes, but obviously I wanted to. When I was first thinking of the book, I had this idea, wouldn't it be great if I could come up with a title that was just all verbs? Just in the title itself, it said that this is a book about verbs. But then I wanted to pick verbs. I wanted to pick verbs that had some different characters. Some of the verbs like hex is a little more archaic. It sort of gives a nod to some older English, and to it signals that we have these old words in the language that have a certain kind of legacy. Then, of course, smash, which is gives a little bit of onomatopoeia. It's kind of fun. Smooch, which is a little irreverent. That's the kind of subversive side of me coming out, and vex also being this kind of vex in a way is a great verb, because a lot of what I'm writing about in the book are things that vex us. I mean, the things that we can't figure out about language. So I kind of liked, first of all, I just liked what they conveyed, and that they conveyed something about the history of the language, and then I love the way that they just played off of each other in sound. There's a little bit of rhyme, there's a little bit of alliteration, there's a little bit of assonance, and so I liked that, because, as you know, Barbara, a lot of what I write about is, and what I was talking about in my conversation with my professor at Princeton, is I love the oral quality of English. I love the sound of words, the sound of sentences, the way that words can make music on the page. So I wanted to find something in the title that did that. But then also digging a little bit more deeply into the history of English, I love it that vex, hex, smash, and smooch, if you go into the etymology of each word, it tells you a lot about English. So vex, for example, is an old French. It comes from an old French word, and behind that, Latin. Hex is actually a verb that sprang up out of Pennsylvania Dutch. It's kind of a German word, but it actually was coined in the United States. Smash, we have no idea where it came from. It kind of entered the language in 1850. Probably someone put the word mash and the word smack together and ended up with smash and rather liked it, and it stuck around. In fact, smash is now one of the 500 or so most common verbs in the language, even though we don't know where it came from. And smooch is a little bit of a mystery, too. There was a English dialect in 1570 that used the word smooch, and then there's kind of a German Yiddish word smooch, but we don't really know where that came from either. So I like what those words encode in terms of the story, the bigger story of English.
Interesting. I'd love to hear you read from the book. Would you do that?
I would. Of course, it's hard to read from a book like mine because some of my favorite passages are written by other people. You know, my book works a lot by quoting writing, wonderful writing, everything from Beowulf to Bob Marley. I go really from the earliest of English literature to contemporary tweets and ad campaigns, and that's part of the fun of the book, but I thought I would read something that's actually in my voice, and I'm going kind of smack in the middle of the book in the history of language and writing about, it's the beginning of chapter 4, which the title of chapter 4 is The Grammar Wars, The Tension Between Chaos and Control, and it's a subject that really fascinates me. We still have grammar wars. People disagree vehemently about language and about English and about what English should be. And so I was fascinated in this book to write about that, to do a little bit of research on that, and to write about it not only in the Middle English period, but all the way to the present. So this takes us back to the time of Shakespeare. "Our language is in a manner barbarous," said the critic John Dryden in 1693. "Other men of letters," and they were all men, fretted that English was unbridled, wild. It lacked the cold, hard rules that made Latin so tidy. These guys were reacting to the times. It was the era of Shakespeare and company, who flouted tradition, invented new words, and conjured savage metaphors. Meanwhile, the printing press was spreading the word, or rather, the tens of thousands of them. Nouns and verbs were shifting around, cross-dressing as easily as Viola in Twelfth Night. English was changing so fast, some poets feared that their works wouldn't be understood by future generations. Others wanted to elevate English, to polish its sentences. Still others wanted to police them. This new class of codifiers looked to classical Latin, the queen of tongues, as a model. Latin had a grammar. Latin was permanent. Latin was classy, or at least classic. These types hoped not only to fix the English language, but to give it mythic immortality. Welcome to the Grammar Wars, a four-century-long argument over whether English is a garden of earthly delights or an Eden waiting to be tamed. By the mid-1700s, the battle lines were drawn between chaos and control, literary license and proper prose, unruliness and firm rules. In no time, clerics would be giving us grammar, and clerks named Johnson and Webster would be straightening out spelling. In the meantime, the language kept mutating, and verbs marched forward with abandon.
Thank you so much. That was Constance Hale reading from Vex, Hex, Smash, and Smoosh, Let Verbs Power Your Writing, published by Norton. In reading aloud, and you talked right before you read about loving, you know, language, loving oral speech. Do you recommend then reading your work aloud to get it right, or after you have a draft to then read it aloud? Because you do talk in the book about pitch and tone, which all to me says music, that there should be music in your writing.
Yeah, and there also is always, you always want to have a sense of an audience. You know, who's at the other side? The reader. So the best thing about reading your work out loud is it's the best way to get a sense of how a reader will receive it, because sometimes we just know what the sentence is. We know the sentence in our own mind, or we know what we're trying to say, and sometimes reading it out loud makes it clear that there's a little, oh, it's hard to get over this little bump in the road, or it just, something doesn't make sense. Not only do I believe in reading my own language, my own writing out loud, and I think when you do that, you start to be much better at hearing it even when you're writing. In other words, when you're not, you just hear things more easily in your head. But when I teach writing, and we do little exercises in class, or sometimes we read out loud in workshops pieces that we've written and brought to class. I actually have other people, so I have all my students pass their papers one person over and have someone else read the piece. I think it's great to hear someone else read a piece of your writing, because then you really hear where the speed bumps in the road are. You hear it in the way that a reader reads it, and that can be very valuable to figuring out things you want to smooth over or things that work really the way you intended them to work.
Interesting. We're at the end of our time, and I wonder if you have any words of wisdom for the writers listening.
You know, I think when I do a manuscript, I have one pass of the manuscript, one rewrite, one draft stage that's just a verb check, where I go through my draft and I circle every verb in every sentence and I ask myself, have I picked the best one here? And I try to take note especially of whether I'm overusing is and are and was and were, which are really quiet verbs. Sometimes they're appropriate, but oftentimes the sentence can be recast with a dynamic verb, and then all of a sudden the sentence comes alive in a new way. So that's one little tip. I think, you know, very easily you can just go through and identify. Just take a look. Take one moment to go through the whole manuscript and see how you're using verbs and whether you really are using them for all they're worth.
That's great. That's a great tip, too, because, you know, just changing passive verbs to, you know, more interesting active verbs can make such a difference in a manuscript.
And we forget to do it. Sometimes we're so caught up in what we're trying to say that we forget to go through and just check that one thing, and yet it can completely change the manuscript.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for being on
the
show again.
It's wonderful to be able to talk about this stuff with another writer like you. So my pleasure.
Well, I love your stuff, and when I see articles or pieces by you in magazines, I love those too. So thanks so much for contributing to literary life in the world. Thanks.
Great. I'll talk to you again.
That was Connie Hale. Her book is Vex, Hex, Smash, Smoosh. Her first book was Sin and Syntax. Love her stuff. And we're going to take a real quick break. When we come back, we will be here with Tatjana Soli. So stay with us. Don't go anywhere.
Darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Radio broadcast that features a dog named Molly. Weekly Signals with Nathan Callahan and Mike Kaspar. News with a Bite. Friday mornings at 8 here on KUCI 88.9 FM. Radio that keeps on giving.
Views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org and iTunes College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. The first half, we were here with Connie Hale, author of Vex, Hex, Smash, and Smooch. Say that one real fast. And we're back with Tatjana Sully. Before we bring her on, let me tell you to go to my website, penonfire.com, for more info on the show and for the Pen on Fire speaker series that takes place here in Orange County, and so much more. Tatjana has been on the show before, and I'm a fan of her work, and I wanted to bring her on to talk about her new book, The Forgetting Tree, a little bit about her. She's a novelist and short story writer. She was born in Salzburg, Austria, attended Stanford and the Warren Wilson MFA program. Her debut novel, The Lotus Eaters, was a New York Times bestseller and a 2010 New York Times notable work. Book. Her work has been twice listed in 100 Distinguished Stories and Best American Short Stories and nominated for the Pushcart Prize. Her best-selling debut novel, The Lotus Eaters won the James Tate Black Prize and was also a New York Times Notable Book, a finalist for the LA Times Book Award, and an American Library Association Notable Book. She lives here in Orange County with her husband, and her new novel is The Forgetting Tree, published by St. Martin's. Hi, Tatiana.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Great to have you on again.
Thank you.
Talk about The Forgetting Tree and where this book came from.
It was kind of a reaction after I had finished The Lotus Eaters, and you know, I had my mind in a historical novel in a far off place, and I just really wanted to have another type of experience as a writer. So I wanted to do something close to home, which is what we all have in Orange County, and talk about the citrus groves and the rural farms that are disappearing. It seemed like an interesting starting place.
And is that where it started? I mean, you know, wanting to do something historical, and then your characters and the situation and conflict in the book, how did that all develop? Can you track back to sort of the progression of, you know, from setting and maybe type of story to then the actual kind of story of the novel, the narrative?
Yeah. When I was thinking, you know, about, you know, what I wanted to write about, and, you know, this, when I was, you know, the setting, because I've lived here since the late 80s, and all of the farms that we used to walk through are disappearing, I very much wanted to kind of record a place in the act of disappearing. And so at the same time as talking about a disappearing landscape, I wanted to have a character who's fighting against it, who it angers. And so the character of Claire came to me, and she married into the Citrus Ranch as a young woman, and she's like, I would say, you know, the recent convert to a faith is the most devout. She's really devout. She loves this way of life. She can't imagine leaving it. And so that seemed to have, always when you have a character like that, you know, that kind of ignites everything else because they're stubborn. So that was the beginning, really.
And then a bit into the book, a sort of controversial, questionable character named Minna comes to take care of her. Talk about that one, that character, and how she found her way into your book.
Yeah, well, so what happens to Claire is that they have a tragedy in their family, and, you know, different families, you know, some, you know, get stronger and some break apart, and Claire's family breaks apart, and so she's living a very isolated ranch life on this ranch, you know, and everything around her is disappearing, and so she needs to have hire a caretaker for, you know, she's developed breast cancer, so she needs to go through the treatments and have somebody there on the ranch with her. And so she hires this really exotic, beautiful girl named Minna, who has this you know, astounding background, and she's kind of the opposite of everything that Claire's life has been up to this point. And I think in a way this is the distraction from her situation, her life situation, both her life situation and her illness situation, and these two women form this bond. And then we realize that Minna isn't the person that she is portraying herself to be. So it becomes kind of dark and mysterious, I guess.
Did any novels influence you in the writing of this book?
Yeah, you know, I very much wanted to include bookish people in this one, and I love The Wide Sargasso Sea by Jean Rhys, and it just seemed, for some reason, this character having a relation to, I mean, she talks about her relation being the great-great-granddaughter of Jean Rhys, but also coming from the Caribbean, and I wanted to have elements of that book, because that book, once you read that book, you can never read Jane Eyre the same, because the madwoman in the attic actually, you know, had a life, and so that was, you know, not in the same way, but I wanted to have that type of mystery in my own book, so that you think a character is one thing, and then you get her backstory, I guess we'll call it, and you realize it's a whole other thing. So that kind of dynamic in a book interested me.
Will you read to us from The Forgetting Tree?
Sure. I'll just read a quick page from the prologue. This is by Octavio. He's the foreman of the ranch. He was a respectable and loyal man, Octavio Mejia, the father of six children, and he had been late to leave that day, treating an infestation of whitefly on the newly planted Valencia trees. It was a Friday evening. His daughter is quinceañera, and he hurried the stick shift into reverse and stepped hard on the gas with his heavy, rubber-soled work boot, even as the car bounced over a small mound under the lemon tree where he had parked for shade. Forrester and Claire had insisted that he go on with the family celebration, even though they would not attend. But he was also in mourning for the missing boy. Did they not see? Octavio had worked hard his whole life and mainly had a mountain of bills to show for it. The quinceañera had cost his whole paycheck for 2 months, Forrester chipping in a hefty bonus, and even then his wife, Sophia, and his teenage girls were not quite satisfied that it would outshine the neighbors' recent parties. It was late, the week so merciless it was one only the devil could be responsible for. He, Octavio, the only one cleared to do basic maintenance on the ranch to keep things alive. The police had finally allowed the irrigation stations to be turned on again, the rusting wheels screeching in protest, the hollow thunder of water tumbling down dusty tunnels after 2 weeks lying dry during record heat. Lizards, believing they had found homes in new cool caves, now dropped and rolled through the deluge of water like judgment, either saved at the end of a pipe or drowned against the wall of a sprinkler head, stunned by the sudden, unfathomable change to their world. As slowly as the police covered the land, it would take them a year to pour over all 580 acres. The immediate perimeter of 50 acres around the house and sheds yielded nothing. The ranch turned a parched, closed face to them. Water meant that the fruit would be saved, the harvest sold, the bills paid, but it also meant that whatever marks might be left from that night would now be washed away forever. No, he did not notice the mound, the freshly turned earth, thinking only of gophers, eternal bane of farmers, as he prepared to drive home. But he stopped the pickup tree a few yards away, the engine idling, and tried to recall something that buzzed, teased at the edge of his memory. He snatched an orange on the dashboard, wedged against the windshield to keep it from rolling back and forth or dropping to the floor to be crushed beneath his boots. It was impossible to tell if the lack of water during the hot weather had done damage. Orange trees died from the inside out, the hurt not visible until long after the climb.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
That was Tatiana Soli reading from The Forgetting Tree. I'm always envious of novelists who can write about difficult situations, who can take their characters whom they love, because especially their main characters, you have to love them to spend so much time with them, and yet cause bad things to happen. Talk about that. Talk about your main character and kind of your relationship with her and with, having her go through something that is, for a very long time, unpleasant.
I don't want to always be writing about dark things, but I guess as a novelist, you're attracted to dark things. I think when you write a book that's important to you, my first book was that way, and this one is too. You want to write about a character overcoming the things that you're afraid to even think about. So, you're trying to imagine what's unimaginable and see. It's kind of like when you're playing with dolls and you're trying to have that experience with your doll and seeing if they can make it through. And so it's things that you think about in real life, thinking of having a tragedy in your family or going through a disease. Those are the type of things that, none of us want to have happen, but we wonder how we would react if it did happen to us. And so you get to play on a very deep level in a novel, and you want to have good things happen to your characters, but you also want to keep it real and keep it complicated and not make it, a Disney picture. You want to, make it a real redemption or a real coming through instead of a faked one.
That's really interesting to me, because I think, one of the things I have to fight when I'm writing fiction is allowing the bad things to happen. And I think part of me probably has difficulty with that because I'm afraid that if I write about them, I'm going to attract them to me.
Oh, absolutely.
As opposed to, what would happen if this happened?
Yeah.
That's a great way of looking at it. What would happen if this happened? How would I deal with it? How would somebody deal with this? Instead of, I might attract this to me, so I'm not going to write about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's difficult. And, you know, even with my first book, you know, the circumstances of war, it's really hard to put your mind in those places. It's kind of scary. And so you have to make sure that the journey is worth it, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You started out as a short story writer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find it necessary? Do you find it advisable? Would you tell new writers or writers who may not be new but are breaking into fiction to start with short stories?
Well, you know, I kind of feel two ways on that. I found my agent found me through writing short stories and having them published in quarterlies. And so, I mean, it is definitely, when you publish stories, the people in the industry are probably the only people that read some of the smaller quarterlies, but they're very well respected. And so it is a way to, you know, give yourself a legitimacy. And it's also, I don't even know if it's easier because, you know, the quarterlies are extremely competitive, but it's nice to be getting feedback from editors. And to publish a book, you're blocked with the gatekeepers of having an agent. So I think it's a good starting off point. But, you know, I don't think not all writers are short story writers. You know, some of us are novelists, and the short story form doesn't come naturally or fit well. So it's kind of unfortunate when you go through college that the workshops, they focus by necessity on, you know, they can workshop a short story in an hour where a novel is impossible. So it's kind of what you get stuck with first.
It's interesting. What about prizes and contests? Because, you know, you've won the James Tate Black Prize, and I don't know if you applied for it or if your publisher applied for you, but I know I get the question a lot from students and others whether to, you know, try for the Glimmer Train Prize or this award or that award. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it just depends if you have extra money and there's, you know, a fee to get your piece in there. Go for it. And on the other hand, I think Ron Carlson said that he runs the MFA program here. He said, you know, that's a great way to get yourself out of bed and writing, but everybody's getting out of bed and writing for that contest or award. So what do you think about that?
That's a hard one. I don't think I did when I was first writing. I did apply to them and got the runners up and everything, but I don't know necessarily that it made any difference. I think, you know, the Best American Short Stories and the Pushcart Prize, that's the nominations from the editors of the quarterlies, so you have no part in that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, whatever you can do to motivate yourself to work, but I think just even being published in a good quarterly, my goal would be, you know, economically also, it's really expensive.
Right.
So I think just getting published in a really good quarterly is as good as winning many contests.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of you just said, you know, just being motivated and find a way to do that. Do you find times during the writing of The Forgetting Tree, since that's what we're talking about, or whatever you're working on now, of, you know, hitting those blocks where you don't necessarily feel blocked, but you feel discouraged or you're not really sure where to go with what you're working on? And if so, how did you get through that? How do you push through it? Do you turn to, you know, writers' work that you love and read a bit to break out of it? Do you go for a walk? Do you go on a vacation? Do you call up somebody? What do you do?
Pretty much all of the above. I don't know. I guess most of the writers that I talk to, when we talk about the process, it pretty much feels, you know, hopeless every day. And I'm not exaggerating it. I really think it is that way. I mean, I always think that if you don't feel insecure, you're probably not pushing yourself hard enough. You're probably doing something that is easy for you that you've done before. So, you know, I try to challenge myself every time I, you know, start another novel to do something I haven't done, and it's always scary, and you're always insecure about it. So I give myself really, you know, uninspired goals every day. Like if I finish a certain amount of pages, I can quit. or if I can, I write by longhand, so if I can put it into the computer, I won't go over exactly every line with the, you know, meticulousness that I would do later on. So just, you know, just quantity, and you hope that the quality will come through there. But I just, you know, whatever I have to do, I always read. I'm always reading. I know some, you know, writers think that when they're writing fiction, they stop reading, and that seems really strange to me. And a lot of the students I have, they don't. I don't think they read widely enough. So not just the contemporary writers, but the classics. I think that really fuels you.
Hmm. Yeah. You know what you said about, you know, that probably you need to be feeling a little insecure as a writer, and I was thinking of something a friend of mine, Patricia McFall, who's a novelist, said a long time ago, and she said something to the effect of talent is inverse to confidence. If you're, like, overly confident, you probably either aren't very talented, or at least don't have much to say, or your writing has hit a place where, you know, you haven't pushed past a certain level. I think that's really interesting. It seems the most insecure writers are often the ones with the most to say.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think, I mean, the writers that I really admire, when I have the, you know, the benefit of meeting them in person, they tend to be really humble people, because they realize how incredibly hard it is, and every single book is actually harder than the one before, because you know a little bit more, so you're trying to do more, and so it never gets easier. And I think that if I see that attitude in somebody, I usually can tell. If I see that attitude in a student or something, I usually can tell that they're really serious about the work, and so that's the prerequisite.
You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I have a few minutes left with Tatjana Soli. Her new book is The Forgetting Tree, published by St. Martin's. I'm curious about just structure and kind of balancing the story. Did you know all that going into The Forgetting Tree? Did you know what you wanted in terms of structure and in terms of how you were going to kind of work the balance with the main character and what's happening with her and in her life?
I did. I think it's a little bit of an unusual structure, and that's, again, going into where you want to push yourself to unknown territory. I wanted to be a little bit more experimental than doing a straight narrative in this, and part of the excitement of writing the book is that I knew I had this embedded mystery that you know, that kind of fueled the turning of the pages and getting through the story, the plot. And so that was an exciting thing, to see if I could succeed with it or not. There are many different ways that you could have structured it, and I resisted that. I wanted to have it a very lifelike kind of flowing out of this woman's life and then of Minna's life.
Hmm.
So that was fun to experiment with.
You know, we talk about marketing on the show, and a lot of writers have very mixed feelings about marketing and social media. What's your relationship with social media, and does your publisher and or agent want you to be on Facebook, be on Twitter, be active, or do you have the rare editor / agent that, you know, doesn't really push you in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how other people's, you know, publishers are, for example, but usually they're, you know, too busy to care. And so it's kind of up to you. I think that the closest analogy is like when you have a child, and if you just, you know, once the book is published, if you just, you know, turn your back on it, you know, are they going to thrive? So the publishing marketplace is really, really difficult right now, and I think writers that you know, temperamentally are capable of reaching out, I think it's a really good thing. So I do, with my first book, I tried everything, and I realized a lot of it didn't work for me, so I kind of honed in on what I like. I love doing book groups, for instance. I like to discuss with readers. I love doing library talks and stuff like that, and so I like to reach out to, you know, fans, and I think you need to do something, because the days of just sending the book out and then staying in your house are gone, unfortunately.
Yeah, they sure are. And but it's so interesting because, you know, a lot of writers have very adverse reaction to the marketing, you know, push.
I don't never look at it as that it's about me at all. I always look about it that it's only about the book, you know. And so you've spent so many years of your life on this, you know, piece of work, and you really do want people to go read it. So that helps me mentally, is that that's what your goal is to have people read, you know, this thing that you labored so hard at. But it's the opposite of what we're meant to do. We're meant to be alone and be writing, and, you know, and all of that cuts into your writing time, which is also difficult.
Yes, it is. So much to take up our time these days. Was maybe a little easier when we didn't have to deal with the internet and computers, but it's also much fun. It's hard to keep the discipline going. But in any case, we're at the end of our time, and I wonder if you have any advice for the writers listening.
Advice.
Somebody on their way who's maybe midway through a book and has hit that middle spot where, you know, it's not the glimmery beginning and the end is far off and they feel like maybe they're in Kansas and they don't want to turn back and they don't want to go forward because it's so far.
I always say that the most important part of the journey is the project you choose. You have to pick something that's really important to you, that's the book that you were meant to write, that you want to read. That's really important because that gets you through those long, dry stretches. If you try to chase market trends or try to, you know, think, oh, well, these books are selling, and you write something that doesn't come from inside, it's really, really difficult. I don't think that even can be forced. So you have to find the right subject, the right book to write.
Mm-hmm. That's great advice, actually, because especially if you're working on a book length manuscript, it really does take a while, and
takes way too long.
Thank you so much for being on the show again, and let's remind listeners to go to your website, touchonasoli.com, to find info on where you're going to be and what's going on in your writing life event-wise. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
You're welcome. That was Touchana Soli. Her new novel is The Forgetting Tree, published by St. Martin's Press. That's all the time we have today. Remind you to go to my website, penonfire.com, for info on the show and events and all kinds of other things, classes, workshops in the area. Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine. My book is Pen on Fire, and I will be back with you next week. Keep writing.